Hello and welcome to episode number 62 of the podcast More Than Tones, Music Education and Society. This episode is based on a video conference in which music education students from the University of Music Lübeck talk to David Lines, Associate Professor of Music Education and Associate Dean of Curriculum at the University of Auckland, New Zealand. We were almost 18,000 kilometers apart from one another when we had this conversation. However, and when it comes to talking about processes that concern music education, our experiences created a sense of connection. The starting point of our conversation is David Lines' paper, A Piano Mismatch, Passion, Dreams and a Good Boy. It will be published in the forthcoming The Companion of Music, Autoethnography and Reflexivity, edited by Peter Gouzouasis and Chris Wiley. We hope you enjoy listening to David's autobiographical account and our conversation.
So first of all, just a few things about autoethnography. I've come to discover autoethnography as a research tool. And as Daniela said, I've explored other research approaches like philosophical research, where you really sort of get into the ideas of music education, qualitative research. I did a really big study with early childhood with very young children and using community artists in early childhood centers. And then also quantitative research a few years back, dealing with lots of data and building kind of statistical tools around that. But I like autoethnography, which I've been writing recently, because it allows entry into like a more personal zone. And I think that's really important for music educators. Music making and music learning can be very personal and close up experiences. And autoethnography provides us with an opportunity to uncover our connection and passion with music. The autoethnographer seeks an embodied stance, the researcher's personal body and felt experience as research instrument. And this is perhaps a little different from other research approaches. It's very personal and it's embodied. And, you know, you think the music experience is really about our body. It's about what we do, what we feel, what we think, how we act in and with music. And this is a really difficult research area too. But what's helped me through it is learning not to worry too much about getting it right, as you might with other research approaches, because we're dealing with memories anyway, and memories, you know, can fade, and memories can be like fictions, really. Because when we think back to what has happened, you know, we're just sort of going on what we think we know what happened, and it's really hard to sort of be truthful with that. But that's kind of not the point with autoethnography, actually. It's an opportunity to present a subjective experience that's like a personal human experience alongside other carefully selected research contexts. And, you know, in the article, I selected this idea of musical passion, which I started to read about in music psychology. So what I want to do now is just to read a little bit of the story. I'm not going to read the whole lot, but I'm going to play some music as well, because I think that'd be quite a nice way to share it. So I hope you can hear but in the background. Where did you learn piano, Martha? I asked my piano teacher. Oh, Martha brightened up as if she was delighted to be asked about this. Oh, I went to London first on a scholarship at the Royal Academy. What was that like? I probed. Memory seemed to kindle something in her. She bristled with passion at the thought of her past life as a serious piano student. Oh, it was wonderful, but really, really hard. Oh, what do you mean hard, Martha? Well, I was a young woman from New Zealand. Everything was so fresh and new in Europe. So new and exciting for me. But to excel on piano, you had to work really hard. And there were people from all over the world there, and you needed to work hard to be noticed, be special. I soon actually moved to Italy, and I had a most wonderful teacher there. It was like living the dream. Her face lit up with the enthusiasm of her voice. Sounds exotic, I mused. It's all about the music, David. If you loved music, it was special. You worked hard at it and it paid off. It's impossible to be perfect. We're only human, of course. The process of trying is intoxicating. You never quite reach what you want to reach, but you're there to try. I hardly saw my teacher. He would often be gone on tour. He's a concert pianist, you know. But I would just be looking around at the museums, the ballet, the art galleries. I took it all in like a sponge. I made the most of it. Everything. Quite different from little old New Zealand then, I joked. Oh yes, a world away, she laughed and smiled, retaining the pleasure of the memory one more time. But that's enough of that talk now. What have we got today? Let's hear your bark. A passion is defined as a strong inclination towards an activity that people love, find important, in which time and energy is invested, and it becomes an integral part of someone's identity. End of quote. Martha's passion certainly embodied this definition. She lived for her music and life at the piano, a passion of service to music. My own musical world was different from Martha's. Although I developed a great feel for classical piano and I enjoyed it, music for me at the time was what you might call being bi-musical. My passion for music lay somewhere between the classical piano on the one hand and jazz and improvisation on the other. My passion for jazz started through listening to recordings. And it went from there. There was one recording, Skull Blues, this is actually it. Oscar Peterson on piano, Stefan Grappelli on violin. It was a live recording, piano, violin, bass, drums, and you can hear a little bit of guitar in there too. There was one piece, Skull Blues, it just swung. This is it. And as a 12-year-old, I can remember this, I was mesmerized by the driving swing rhythms. To my young ears, Skull Blues beat to life. I would play this album over and over again, dreaming and imagining about it. That began a new passion for improvised music. It evolved into hours of experimenting, listening, audiating, and then playing lines on the piano. I developed flow and fluency around blues chords initially. Then I moved to other progressions after that. The pianists would know about that. This unfolding passion was an autonomous, self-initiated passion, a crystallization of things I sensed and loved about this kind of music. Okay, another German composer. Play these two bars very, very slowly, instructed Martha. A few weeks later, I was studying the G minor Bach prelude, sitting at Martha's grand piano at her home. Martha taught at home and at university. I was a high school student, one of her home pupils. She closed her eyes in a dramatic listening gesture, and I obediently began to work my way through Bach's carefully constructed musical lines. Three interweaving musical parts. Play it again and listen. Listen to every note, every sound that you play. I played it again and again, dutifully, attentively. I was a good boy. Do this at home, over and over again. Make it liquid, she said. Okay, Martha. Later that evening, I practiced the Bach on my own. I started to play it slowly, considering the sounds of each note, as she said, each figure, each gesture. Bach is wonderful at creating independent melodic lines. My ears, mind, and fingers enjoyed feeling the tactile movement of the melodies. I felt like I was learning the close-up qualities of Bach just by playing them. The bass line moved gently, plodded along with the tempo, and then, suddenly, as if it needed a special identity, it began to move around. The beauty and form of Bach unfolded under my fingers. This task of close listening and of intimately sensing the sounds resonated with me. It made me feel closer to the piano and the music. The music went directly to my ears and to my fingers. I liked them. Martha's passion caught on. As I got better at piano, I started to learn an extremely difficult prelude by another German composer, Hindemith. The piece was very dissonant and had no apparent tonal center, and learning it became a procedure of internalizing one note after the other in single and then both hands. It felt like learning Bach on steroids, without the harmonic signposts. In practice time, I mindlessly repeated phrases again and again to get them into my muscle memory. And after many repetitions, the physical patterns kicked in, and I was able to move through the piece quite well. I kind of worked a muscle memory, if you know what I mean. After about an hour of going through this process, I stopped and I considered what I was doing. I suddenly thought maybe I should just try a different pathway. This was quite a naughty thought, really, because I've been taught to follow notation, but my jazz leanings kicked in, and I gave myself permission. I began with the Hindemith piece for a while, and then I allowed myself to continue playing beyond the score. I was, say, about 14 years old at the time. You know, it sounded great to me. I was really delighted at this discovery. This started a new kind of passion. As a musician, I could expand on and creatively develop anything I wanted, score or no score. A piano mismatch. Some years later, Martha and my passions were due for a collision. I was now a university music student, majoring in piano, maybe like some of you, under Martha's tutelage. It was music lesson day. "Start warming up," she called out. I started playing a few scales. And now that I was a full-time university student in music, classical piano became my main focus, sort of. Martha came back into the room and greeted me properly. This was the official start of the lesson. We had a brief conversation about what I'd been working on, and then it was straight into the pieces I'd been preparing. One piece chosen by Martha was a piece by Mozart, really slow, and I had to work my fingers around it. "We're going right back to the basics," she said. "We need to start you over again to get some control on your fingers." According to Martha, my playing had been lacking detail and technical control. A diet of modest works and slow practice was prescribed for a few months until these things came right. "Play it again," she commanded softly. "And again. Again. One more time. Again." I struggled through the section, engaged in part, but somewhat detached. And then I went into what you might call autopilot. Really, I just followed her instructions. "Work on this just like in the lesson, David." Back at home, I worked on it to a degree, but my mind and my sense of creativity continued to be fueled by my other musical passions. My home practice was beginning to be more and more dominated by the jazz and improv studies. But at the same time, I knew I needed to be a good boy and learn all the material that Martha had for me. Even though this approach was expected of a serious piano student, there was something about the absolute obedience of the musical diet that turned me off. I liked some of the pieces, and I enjoyed learning new classical pieces, but I still had the desire to play with more freedom in ways that connected with my own musical passions. So at home, I'd spend as much time working my way around chords and improvised lines as I did with Martha's pieces. I liked the thought of building more personal piano repertoire. And this meant jazz, gospel, rock, blues. I imitated pianists. I considered bass lines, harmonic voicings, solos, all sorts of things. I developed a really good ear, actually, and could reproduce any kind of musical line at any moment's notice. And this produced very satisfying instant musical feedback and gave me a great deal of musical self-confidence. But it had a downside. My careful practice was often attempted, but I didn't spend enough time on what Martha wanted. The next lesson, I set out somewhat awkwardly into the piece from the homework list that was only half studied. I was caught up in denial, still trying to be a good boy, but now not delivering anything of substance. I faltered and I stopped. This was too much for Martha. She gave a big sigh, sat back in her chair. You haven't worked on this, have you? You really need to be a lot more dedicated and serious about your piano study, David. I didn't quite know how to respond. I knew I'd been doing my thing, but it was very hard to explain this mismatch to Martha. I just kept quiet, really. What are you actually doing when you practice? She demanded. Well, I started truthfully, but not very persuasively. I like to play around a lot and just explore ideas, I said. And then I work a bit on your stuff. In a moment of annoyance, she then launched into a more personal tone. You really are a dreamer, aren't you, David? You don't really work. You just play about. A bit about music psychology. Music psychology research has explored how musicians can adopt different kinds of passion. Some harmonious, some obsessive. Harmonious passion prompts a musician to freely choose to engage in music for the pleasure derived from it, without external or internal pressure. It enhances a musician's sense of autonomy with their music making. Harmonious passion people usually derive positive emotions and reduce stress from participating in their favorite activity. And as an enhanced, and they feel enhanced perceived psychological well-being. In contrast, obsessive passion results from musicians feeling controlled by external or internal pressures. This drives their involvement in music. This results in an unmanageable urge to engage in the musical activity that they love, sometimes creating conflict with other areas of their life. So this comes from the music psychology research. My own crossover experience, this is me, the autoethnographer, thinking about it, of breaking away from the score became a new passion that brought me creative pleasure and increased autonomy and a number of other things. But was I being a good boy? A sense of conflict continued and in the end led to a breakdown in this lesson, and I felt disempowered as a student. On the other hand, Martha's passion for classical music was obvious. She took great pleasure in telling all those stories about her past. A love of and service of music. This was very much caught up in her identity as a master piano teacher. The source of her passion, and to a degree I would call it obsessive, but I can talk more about that later. It was different from mine at the time, for it came from a strong response to external expectations of piano culture. The need to dedicate your whole life to and be obedient and comply with your master teacher's wishes. I think this is an important part of my paper. The differences in passion between us as teacher and student were actually quite clear. Although perhaps it'd be unfair to say that it was completely opposite, because I felt the obligations of the piano culture, and Martha also had a great deal of harmonious passion too. So what does this all mean for music education? This is the big question, you know, when you do a research topic like this. Well, it's interesting. I've now kind of experimented quite a bit with jazz and improvisation, and the piece I'm playing now is a recording of a free improv session I did with a band. And it was based on working off a classical music piece, actually. So it's interesting where your pathways go, isn't it? Piano teachers, though, I think can seek to develop more awareness of the different kinds of musical passion and self-efficacy, which I talk about in the paper, in themselves and their students. This suggests that training in piano pedagogy can maybe build more awareness of this. Perhaps using autoethnography, or perhaps self-reflection, group reflection, sharing ideas. Music teaching and learning can be a kind of practice that operates in a bubble. You know, it's just you and your teacher. It fails to recognize the individual musical passions, you know, the way music has impacted on our own separate lives. So I feel we need to become reflexive people, as researchers, as teachers, as students, as musicians, and use relational and conceptual tools like these. Maybe they can help teachers and students see beyond their immediate position as experienced teacher or vulnerable learner.
Thank you, David. That's how we do it here in Germany, like clapping on the table to say thank you. Thank you, first of all, for sharing your very personal story. And it's different, right? Hearing him tell a story from reading his story. It's even more personal. And touching in another way. It touched me in another way. But I don't want to be the first one who's asking a question now. So I want to give the students the opportunity to start the conversation.
Could you explain why we as students constantly feel the need to be a good boy, a good girl, a good student, or whatever? Where does it come from?
Yeah, because I think that, I coined that term, a good boy. It just sort of came to me because I've been struggling to work out what this research was all about, you know, and it was like, what is it actually about? Because at first it was kind of like a rejection of my teacher, but now I've sort of gone right full circle, and I really appreciate what my piano teacher did for me. You know, I think that's more a mature position to have. And I think, so the good boy thing was these expectations, because, music worlds can have lots of expectations, particularly as you get more advanced. And you have like schooling and university, and you have these music schools and institutions. But then you also have, I think there are rules around different styles and genres. There are histories, there are ways of doing things. And there are quite important people who say, well, this is important, so everyone else should think that's important, this kind of way of playing or this sort of music. So there's quite a lot of that kind of structure, I think, in Western culture, but I think it's in Asian cultures too, because we have quite a few Asian students from China, Korea, and so on, in New Zealand. And they tell me about this too. So, I think it's a global thing, but in serious music culture, there's quite a strong, it's what you might call a discipline, of discipline, meaning it's like a system of rules and traditions, and it's quite strong in music. So when we do feel that, don't we? And we often feel it through our personal relationships with people. And so in my case, it was, with this wonderful, excellent piano teacher. I mean, she was like the best teacher in New Zealand at the time. She's since passed away, actually. But she was like, one of the really excellent piano teachers. And she's had some quite famous pupils who've done very well on piano. But, so the tradition is passed on, and we feel the sense of obligation of like to do the right thing, And then I think there might be a personality thing associated with it too, because, some of us, I think, want to be good children, if you know what I mean, and do as what the teacher says as well. And some of us are more rebellious, perhaps. I don't know. Did that make any sense?
Totally. Yeah. Thank you.
And maybe it's a choice that we have if we want to be a little bit more rebellious sometimes, maybe. And maybe that's something readers could take out of your personal account, that we have a choice sometimes.
Because I think sometimes, being a good student, like a good boy, or in my case, but a good student, sometimes it can cause us some damage.
Yeah. Ariadne, you would like to ask a question, I think.
You said at one point, I'm not sure anymore, but that it is hard work, and you used this term of hard work. I was just wondering, I believe that many things that we learn are hard work in a way. So even learning to read or something. And I'm wondering, where does hard work lead into something positive? And where does it create this, oppressive feeling? Or how did you say it, this pressure? How can we maybe monitor this in our students, that they feel that hard work I don't know, gets transferred in something positive, because I think many passions develop through work and not, you know, this genius idea that we have.
Thank you for that question. I think that's a really interesting question. And I agree with you. I agree that, you know, like when we do something well in music, it often is a result of hard work. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it doesn't feel like it. Like when I'm playing jazz in a band and I'm having such a great time, and, you know, like some gigs just go really, really well and it just feels like a breeze, you know. But then I reflect on it and I think that I've done lots and lots of practice that led up to that situation. You know, I've actually done lots of hard work on the piano in the jazz context, you know. So I totally agree with you, you know. So I think we do need to have hard work, and that, you know, like that was part of Martha's story when she talked about being a successful concert pianist, you know, when she was learning that you just have to do that, don't you? And I think if you want to be a professional musician, you need to put those hours in, don't you? There's no faking it. You need to put the hard work in. So I really believe that's part of being a musician. There are all sorts of kinds of musicians, but I think if you want to be like a really skillful musician, you need to put in that hard work. Yeah. I think maybe the problem is allowing for some freedoms within the hard work, you know, so that it's not just the hard work that someone else tells you what to do and you just do it like totally, like to the letter, obediently. But there's kind of like, I sort of feel that a musician needs to develop their own musical self at the same time. And I think some teachers sort of do that quite well. And so they can like, you know, it's like becomes a little bit of more of a dialogue between the teacher and the student. And the hard work kind of is a shared thing, but it's and might be a little bit more diverse than, you know, that really scripted, you know what I mean by scripted, like prescription. So, however, I think if you need to learn certain musical pieces, you just need to do those exercises, don't you? And do the hard work. So I agree with that. But I think there needs to be some, I've thought about it, and I think it's this creative freedom needs to be there as well. And if you start to do that, then that person will be able to move beyond the teacher at some stage. Because, you know, you get to a certain stage where you sort of don't need your teacher anymore and you can move on. If you've developed that personal autonomy as a musician, yeah, you can sort of move past that. And so this is where I find improvisation is quite good, because it helps you move past that. In my case, for other people, it might be different things, like perhaps even a composition or playing different pieces that they have chosen, you know.
Are there other questions related to this work aspect of making music in our group before we move on to other topics? I have another question. Related to this, you have to work hard thought, or this concept. It was my impression, the way you depicted Martha, your teacher, was like, she said, you need to work hard to be a classical pianist. And I quote from your paper now, you say that with her, you learned the disciplined experiences of classical piano on the one hand, and as a bi-musical being that you were, you had the relative freedom of contemporary jazz and improvisation on the other hand. And I thought about this, that you connect hard work with making classical music, and you connect the practice of making jazz music with other aspects that are maybe not hard work. Was my impression right? Because I felt that there was like some kind of binary thinking maybe in there.
Yeah, I think that does come through the article. And so I think that's, yeah, that's a true sort of account. Although, you know, I think maybe, you know, that binary of the classical and the jazz and the hard work and the sort of easy work, if you know what I mean, isn't quite real. It just feels like that because, you know, what I wanted to do, and I'm sure everyone's like this, you know, like when you want to do your own thing, you kind of, you just whatever is like your passion at the time, you sort of go with it. It's a bit, I've done a lot of self-teaching, like through YouTube. I don't know if anyone else does that. But, you know, you follow things that you're interested in. And then I apply that to like my building improvisation and jazz skills. Yeah, but the thing is, I'm sort of following my own interests, so it doesn't feel like hard work, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the
And
point.
yeah, and it might not be as structured as, you know, like the hard work at piano, which is like 2 hours practice and you do this, and this. But I think that's a really good point. It's like a different kind of work. But I think if you want to be a good at these other styles and genres and improvisation too, I actually think you need to do hard work, but it's a we're still yet to find out how to do that really, really well. I think we're still finding that out. So yeah, anyway, it's quite a big topic, isn't it? But do you think there's a general impression in music culture that classical music is hard work?
I could definitely relate. Beatrice, you too?
Yeah, me too. I would say so. David, you already said that too. There are so many expectations of how you should play some pieces, and the historic references to that, and also the techniques. And so you always feel the pressure to live up to that expectation, and the freedom you can put into the piece is very limited. I would say it's mostly limited in comparison to other music styles.
But I still think we should be careful with making these binary distinctions, because I remember my jazz professor from Hannover, where I studied, and we had group improvisation classes, and we had to listen to a piece and try to copy the solo. Yeah, that's a technique everybody does, I think, when you learn jazz. And it was maybe not so different to Martha's strategy. Like, we had to learn our scales, and we had to use the right scale over the right chord. So it's also a lot about right and wrong. Yeah. And I think there's one danger in that. A couple of weeks ago or months ago, there was a big discussion here at this University of Music in Lübeck, and you were part of that. We were discussing if it should be allowed to study a jazz or popular instrument when you are a master of music student. And some people in the Senate here voted against it. And I think we have to be careful in some contexts with giving people the impression that making popular music or jazz means you don't have to work that hard. You can just find your own voice, and that's it. And it's not as hard as playing classical music. That's why I think we have to always be careful about these binaries. Is binaries the right word, or binary thinking?
Yeah, both, I think. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's that sort of oppositional thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, no, that's a good point, I think.
In my opinion, the difference is less. Is it popular music or jazz music or is it classical music? In my opinion, the differentiation also for a teaching approach is more, is it more written down music that you learn, or is it improvisation in a style, in a classical style or in a popular music style? Because if you look at some pieces, also some pieces of Bach, especially organ works or preludes or something, they are written down improvisations. And also at our music university, we have a professor who teaches very skilled classical music improvisation on piano. What I miss in the discussion is that you can also achieve improvisation on a classical instrument, or you can achieve or compose or improvise music that sounds classical, but the thinking and the practice and the ideas are techniques you take from improvisation of jazz music genre. So there, in my opinion, there's the differentiation. And in my opinion, it should absolutely be necessary to include improvisation, classical music improvisation, like I'm a cellist, like try to improvise a Bach suite, like solo work for cello. In the style of Bach. This could be a very interesting task. I think many students, also on the university level, would very much like to try for themselves once, but it's never really part of the curriculum.
Yeah, but it could be. You're right. Of
So Bach
course.
wrote six suites for cello, so there are some Tonarten, some scales left where you can write your own Bach suite. So go for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the improvisation in the classical world is gradually developing, slowly, I think. And maybe as a result of the influence of jazz, I don't know, sort of that people are saying, yes, it could be a good thing to do. Because I think historically, it's been very much part of classical music. And if you read about composers, don't you, that they did used to improvise a lot. And, you know, going way back. So I agree. Yeah, no, it definitely isn't. And I think when I grew up, though, it was never, ever part of the lesson. So it might have been my generation. But I think it's starting to, there are some teachers that do it now, and some of them do it in a very free way. I don't know if you've had this experience, but they have workshops where, you know, students learn to improvise, and they there might be special framework, improvisation frameworks, which they work yeah. with, and they kind of do performances on the spot, and the other classmates just watch and listen. And they might have some rules, like it could be just using specific notes, or it could be just like you are accompaniment and I am a melody line or whatever, or it could be you know, something, any note goes in the 12 tone scale, or you know, there's lots of little parameters, but it's more in a classical sort of genre. So, you know, because it mm-hmm. could be like you know, 20th century art music or something. So, you know, I think it's, and it does, some students find that really helpful because it frees up their musicianship and they feel as though they're starting to own the music rather than not just be interpreters, you know, and be, and when you're a performance student, you're playing lots of pieces, but when you're improvising, you're starting to learn about making the music yourself, and that sort of ownership is quite empowering, I think. Although I still really value playing scores. I think that's really important too.
Any follow-up questions to that one, on that topic?
Do you, do you demand students to improvise? And if yes, do you like, do you put extrinsic, like, do you put discipline and structure on them, or do you try to leave it alone?
Loose. Oh yeah. It would depend on the student and the situation. Like, I have taken improvisation workshops, and I think the first part of the workshop needed to be almost like therapy. And like, we had to sort of get rid of our baggage, you know, because you have all this sort of hang up from having to play the right notes all the time. And students get really worried about playing the right notes. Like, am I playing the right thing? And am I being judged, you know? So, I've done improvisation workshops where some people almost like get very emotional. They get really worried. So you have to be, I think you have to be quite careful and sensitive when doing this so that you don't destroy a person's self-confidence, you know, by saying, improvise now, go, you know. yeah. But of course, if you've been doing that a lot and you're a quite experienced student, you might just really like someone to say, improvise now, go, you know? So you've got to be like really careful, I think. And it's almost like, when I say therapy, I think some music students feel they need to revisit everything they thought about music and what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do, and just get rid of that self-judgment, you know, because I suppose that's kind of behind my good boy title in a way. Yeah, good question. Thank you.
My experiences with situations like that are also, if we improvise in a group, and we did that in this room on Saturday, 2 days ago, and it worked really well, but it worked well for certain reasons. And I had other experiences where some very skilled musicians started to show off how well they can play their instrument, how good they are at improv. And others start to feel overwhelmed and get really shy. And that has happened to me. I thought like, oh my God, he's so good. I don't know what to do now. And I think when we lead groups and improvise together, we have to be very careful about this.
Yeah, I love talking about this topic. So yeah, I think it's because some writers describe it as a like a kind of a democracy in action, where, you know, you've got to be sensitive to all the players, and, you know, everyone may have a part. And actually, music education arrangements are sometimes like this, aren't they? You know, where you have, say, if you've got some children who you can just play in this range or something. And so they have their melody here, and then you might have the person over here who can do more sophisticated line, and they have a part to play in the arrangement and all that kind of thing. Yeah, because, you know, you can get into this musical Olympics kind of way of thinking, where, you know, like the fastest and the most virtuoso is good. And, you know, I love virtuoso music, and I used to be really impressed by it when I was younger. Think, oh, wow, what a really fast player or something. Now I've sort of changed my aesthetic, you know, as I got older, and I sort of think I'm really into sort of like slow, beautiful music, and I just love sort of more meditative music here, or maybe just a held tone here, you know. So you sort of challenges your musical aesthetic, you know, about what can happen in an improvisation workshop. And I think that's really, like you say, Daniela, like you can set these parameters, can't you? And a skillful teacher might be able to help people through these different bar frameworks. I used to call them frameworks.
Something to hold on to, something that gives us structure and also safety. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we explored the idea of work, that making music can be hard work. We explored the idea of improvisation and how we can improvise.
Mm-hmm.
What other ideas did you get from David's paper that you would like to discuss?
Some students may bring their own passion or their own want to explore their own freedom in improvisation on one hand. On the other hand, we always had the saying of, but there is structure, and Martha's teaching was based on a very structural approach on which pieces to learn, how to learn them, how to practice some passages in music. My question is also a little bit related to teaching music in schools. Where does Martha's, or maybe your idea, if you also teach piano, come from what structure is supposed to look like? Because my feeling sometimes is that in one-to-one teaching on instruments, what structure and pieces and in which order our students have to learn, that's something the teacher figured out for themselves and maybe learn from their teachers, and their teachers learn from their teacher and so on. But in school, it's generally different. There is some, in German we call it Bildungsplan or Lehrplan, like there's
curriculum,
which is organized by the state, and we as music teachers in schools have to look at this curriculum and have to some degree do what's written in this curriculum. We don't look at our teachers in schools from our school time and say, okay, this is good good teaching, I will now teach the same stuff in school. I think there's a very big difference. What are your comments on that?
Yes, well, I think you're right that what is structure? That is an interesting thing. And I used to think it was like musical analysis, you know, like, it's like the things, the theoretical things that you learn about music and being able to play them, you know. And I think a lot of people still think this, and it's true to a certain extent. So, you know, the whole world of harmony and the way, like, as I'm thinking from a pianist, being able to play chords, being able to play scales, you know. And so, you know, how you can break down all these things into sort of like little wee things that you need to learn, and then you kind of develop it from there. So there's all the structure from the kind of the internal music system, and that might be, and a lot of students in my, you know, that I talk to in my postgrad students would say that, I think they would talk about structure in that way. But it's quite good to I think to challenge the other things in music and expand it out a little bit more, so that it's more kind of multi-dimensional. So there may be other things in that we can learn that are a bit harder to define. Like, it could be some emotional things. There's all these other aspects, because music's actually a very complicated thing, isn't it? So I always like to sort of get quite creative and make my structure really quite diverse. So, you know, then there'll be listening part of it, and there'll be a creating part of it, and there'll be a performing part of it, and you have all these different things. And then you might even like cross over into other arts to sort of for inspiration. But then fundamentally, there may also is the sound components. And I sort of feel with, as an improviser, I work a lot more with timbre. being, you know, like the specific sound of a sound, what it sounds like, you know, so not just thinking analytically, you know, in that kind of mathematical sense, but in the timbre sense, particularly, you know, like I start to be playing with synthesizers, and I'm starting to, I often realize that when I'm working with synthesizers, you've got to think about timbre a lot more. It's not just a keyboard like the piano. Yeah. So when I say what is structure, I think it's quite nice to have a really quite a big vision, and then be able to break it down and have like a balance across different things. And then hopefully then the students will receive, get a sort of develop a literacy of things they can do in music. Yeah. But also have the creative agency to be able to own music, you know, like through improvisation, through creating, through composing, and through interpreting in interesting ways, not just repeating pieces like over and over and over again, the same.
Ariadna, I saw that you raised your hand before. Would you like to ask a question now?
I just wanted to ask if you have any, I mean, you will have key takeaways from your research.
Sure.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I think there's quite a few things, because I think once I start thinking about the paper, quite, there's, you know, and I think we've covered quite a few of the points. But so one would be this idea of creative agency, of kind of, you know, like to help students be musical. Part of their musicality is creating music and having the sort of the feeling that the empowerment to be able to do that, you know. So I feel that's really important, no matter whether you're playing classical music or jazz or whatever, because, you know, like, because you want it to be last your whole life. And you don't want to discover that like 50 years later. You want to sort of discover that earlier. Yeah, so I think that's quite important. The point about relationships, I think, is in there too. So, you know, like we've got the teacher-student relationship and the power relationship. And I think we can just learn from that the sensitivities needed in the power relationship, being aware of there's the curriculum and, you know, like what we talked about with structure. But then also there's the student's life and the fact that music at the end of the day is kind of like a living thing that's part of our lives and we want to participate in it. So bringing that into the equation, so it's not just like we're obedient servants who are just doing what the teacher does, you know, but so that there's like a dialogue between the teacher and the student. So I think that would be a key thing. And to be, I think we need to be wary of the possibility that the power relationship can be inappropriate. Like I was saying, that colleague of mine who basically lost his job and his career because he was, you know, what he had done. So, and you know, and he damaged a lot of people's lives. So I'm sure that sort of thing happens in Germany as well, because teaching music is very personal, isn't it? You know, especially like in the studio, just with the teacher and the student, it's like you're just there with your teacher, so you're quite vulnerable, aren't you? So there's kind of like an ethics conversation going on here too, in my paper. I think I just would like to say that I really do respect Martha as a teacher, because I hinted at that she had this harmonious passion too, but I think there was just like a clash of paradigms really between her paradigm and mine, you know, and we just didn't have a fit at the time, because I was like this frustrated 17-year-old boy. Basically, she even started to give me some jazz exercises, and I always felt that you know, she really liked my playing too. She really liked my playing. It's just that I never was that really obedient student that you know, who sort of went like to all these amazing directions. I kind of like played nicely, but then I went off and did my own thing, you know. So I think she would appreciate the story, actually. And I think she would realize, because she taught very many people, I think she understood that, you know, each student is different and there's these differences between all the students. I think she would have appreciated that. But I suppose with my story is that I felt that the piano culture kind of like sometimes over-dominated that understanding of the difference in different students sometimes.
Thank you, David. That was a very nice ending to our conversation about this paper. Thank you.
This was episode number 62 of the podcast More Than Tones, Music Education and Society. A big thank you to David Lyons for sharing his research with us and the music education students from Lübeck. We are looking forward to receiving your feedback and your thoughts about the topics we talked about. If you want to share them, please go to the blog www.mehralstöne.de. If you're interested in the other English episodes of this podcast, scroll down to October and November 2021, March and April 2021, and September and October 2020. There will be more English episodes in the future, so stay tuned, and in the meantime, enjoy making and listening to music and teaching.